They're illogical. V'lamelech in sheva la'anicha. It is against the best interest of the king to permit such a status quo to continue. Okay. Now we understand why Ahasuerus consented at once to let Haman execute his satanic plan. It is right. He didn't ask even who they are. He had no knowledge who the people is. He had no knowledge. Because when Esther told him, it's a muse of Israel. When a paranoid who lives in fear at some imaginary monster fiend is given an opportunity to fix the blame upon a certain person or group, then all human inhibitions and moral controls are abandoned. The paranoid person has in such a situation one dominant, irresistible urge to destroy, because he thinks that his safety can only be attained through destruction. It's exactly, this describes exactly the mentality of Stalin. And it's the same mentality Ahasuerus had. Esther, that's what Mordechai didn't know. Esther, with her incisive intelligence, understood that no plea addressed to the king would produce any results. His terrible crying, supplications, begging, will at best remain ineffectual. At worst, they may inflict more harm. Since Haman succeeded, and Esther knew that, to brainwash Ahasuerus, and to arouse in him a paranoid, mortal fear of assassins and rebels, there is no human power in the world which will be capable to dissuade Ahasuerus from destroying his imaginary enemies. Could anyone sway Stalin from implementing his mad designs? I mean, Khrushchev writes that many times, I mean, of course, all his cohorts were cowards, they never dared. But once a dare, very close friend, who was a devoted communist, a pioneer, who spent years in the Tsarist jails and prisons, who was suddenly accused of high treason, of conspiring with the United States and England and France, and was sentenced to death. And he simply begged Stalin, did not respond. Begging is useless when a paranoid mind is convinced that someone, or that this individual, is ready to conspire and plot against him. Could anyone sway Stalin from his medicines? He had to exterminate hundreds of thousands who were involved in the imaginary plot. The same was true of Ivan the Terrible, of Peter the Great, and Philip II of Spain. The two, Philip of Spain and Ivan the Terrible, executed their own sons. There's no logical argument which can persuade a paranoid mind that he's wrong in his calculations and thinking. Teaching a paranoid mind, or convincing a paranoid mind, is an absurdity. Esther knew that very well. And that's why she disregarded Mordecai's advice to come into the king and to prostrate herself before him, to cry and to hug his knees and plead for her people. It would have been useless at best. Esther knew that she could avail herself of one method only. What do you say, what method? Namely, to turn the tables on Haman. Not to ask ourselves, not to plead with him, not to petition him. All that will be a futile attempt, but to turn the tables on him.
This is the yeshiva, this is the yeshiva, this is the television, and these are here.
These are mics?
Yeah, these are your mics.
The other question is the cover.
No, this one is basically the PA system, the one around Rosemary.
All right.
Okay, I'll try and see if it's good.
All right, is it audible? No, it's there. No one here. So what?
See if it's good.
All right. No, no. It's a perennial problem here. All right. This is better now. Do you hear me?
No.
No? Do you hear me? Do you have another mic?
Yeah.
Where is it on the table? Perhaps you lower the mic on it. What did you say?
This is a microphone.
This is a microphone, yes. For the,
all right, this and this is my own microphone.
Okay. There is a lot.
Make it a little higher.
No, I don't believe it. All right, let me start, all right? I mean, you all know the saying in Pirkei Avos. Ayin kotzer v'amlocha merubo. Is it audible? It's late, it's 8 o'clock. And the lecturer is lazy and tired and exhausted. And the crowd is big. However, the reward is enormous, I mean, in spiritual times. What I'm going to do today, I'm trying to develop a kind of a metaphysique of poem. It sounds like contradictio in adjecto. I mean, Purim is the day of gaiety. Metaphysique, the word metaphysique, whatever the meaning is, reflects a serious mood. And Purim and a serious mood are mutually exclusive. But let us investigate, and I want to tell you, I'm investigating not only on homiletical grounds or philosophical grounds, but on halachical grounds, an halachic viewpoint. The Gemara Megillah, Tractate Megillah, says, Omer Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Chai Rodom Likris es HaMegillah Balayla, Ulishonei Sobayei. שנאמר לקאי אקרו לחוימום ולסענה לילה ולאיתו מיולי. I'm just quoting now, I'll translate it. אית מנאמה אמר רב חלבו אמר רבולה אמר רולה בירוי חי ודום לקרס סמגילה בלילה ולשני סבאיין שנאמר למען זמר חובית ולידי מדשב לקאי לילה מרבו. Now let me translate it. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, one is duty bound to read the Megillah in the evening and to reread it, to repeat it a second time in the morning. As it is written, proof that the Megillah should be read twice. Oh my God, I call by day, but thou answerest not. And at night, and there is no surcease for me. Then the Gemara continues, Itmaname, we have also learned, the Gemara continues, Rabbi Chelbo, in the name of Ula, of Biroe, of place which was called Biroe, stated, again, one is commanded to read the Megillah in the evening as well as in the morning, as it is written, so that my glory may sing praise to thee, and not be silent, O Lord, my God, I will give thanks unto thee forever. Two identical statements, correct? However, two contradictory reasons. Two prima facie, mutually exclusive verses were quoted by Rabbi Yeshua Berlevi and Ula, who formulated the same halacha. Rabbi Shimon ben Levi quoted the verse from the Psalm 22, the famous Kele Kele Loma Zaftoni Psalm, prayer, most probably of an individual in distress who was forsaken and abandoned by everybody. This psalm reflects the cry of total despair, the shriek of a frightened, lonely child who has suddenly discovered that his mother is gone, that she had left him. Kele kele lama zaftoni. And according to our tradition, this psalm was recited by Esther on her way to the inner court of Ahasuerus, by Yom HaShlishi, on the third day. In a word, it's a psalm of a person who lost almost hope, and out of the depth, the profundis of despair and misery and agony, he petitions the Almighty. From that psalm, Rabbi Shua ben Levi inferred, one must read the Megillah at night as well in the daytime. In other words, the reading of the Megillah was by Rabbi Shua ben Levi identified or equated with the offering of a prayer to the Almighty from the straits of distress. Reading of the Megillah was identified by Rabbi Shua ben Levi with addressing a petition to the Almighty from the depths of agony and misery. Rabbi Chelbo, in the name of Ula, introduced another verse. His verse is from Psalm 30. This is the jubilant psalm of dedication, of thanksgiving by an individual who was miraculously cured. Weeping might have tarried for the night, but joy came in the morning. The sick person who miraculously was saved from death overflows with gratitude. He does not just say thank you to the Almighty. He sings an incessant hymn of praise and hallelujah, a day as well as at night. Therefore, Ula concluded, one must recite the Megillah in the evening and also in the morning. In other words, Ule identifies and equates
The reading of the Megillah with offering of praise and thanks to the Almighty. The Megillah, according to Ulla, is a great song of gratitude, for it is good from to sing praise to the Lord. And in fact, the famous statement by Rabbi Kriosso Zui Hilula, the reading of the Megillah is to be appreciated with the recital of Hallel, confirms Ulla's opinion. Of course, the question arises, what actually is the Megillah? A book of human sorrow and misery, warranting ceaseless supplication and crying, or it is a book of glory and gladness, precipitating the singing of Hallel about God's glory and His majesty? Because according to Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, the book of the Megillah is the book of human sorrow, of human distress. It is the cry of the lonely person to the Almighty. According to Helbo and Ulle, the reading of the Megillah is a jubilant song of thanksgiving and praise for a person who was cured and redeemed by the Almighty. What kind of a book is the Megillah? The answer is simple. Both characterizations are correct. The Megillah contains two stories, not one story. The story of human happiness and fulfillment, as well as the story of human misery and distress, and human loneliness and hopelessness. The reading of the Megillah is a dialectical performance. We do pray while we read the Megillah, because we are in distress. We do thank God while we read the Megillah and relate His wonders, for we have found refuge in Him. He just saved us. Consequently, the whole character of Purim changes. It is not just, as people assume, a day of hilarious feasting, drinking, merrymaking, and gaiety to the extent of self-forgetfulness. I mean, when we speak of Purim, by mere association, we remind ourselves of the famous Maimar and the Gemara. Chai vado visur be Purim yada yada ben boruch Mordechai lor Haman. His Purim is not just a day of hilarious feasting, drinking, and gaiety, but is also a day of introspection and serious self-examination. Purim is a day of meditation. It is contrary to the popular interpretation of Purim. And since mysticism is very popular nowadays in the United States, particularly among the young, any freakish behavior is classified under mysticism. So let me tell you what the mystics say about Purim. The mystics speak of five letters of Purim, which occur also in Yom Kippurim. Apparently, they say, there is a common denominator in both festivals. One is the most hilarious and noisy, and the other one is the most solemn, awesome, and fear-inspiring. But there is a common denominator in both of them. In Yom Kippurim and in Purim. A strange equation has been formulated by the mystics. Right? Could somebody formulate the equation? Right? In mathematical categories, Yom Kippurim equals Purim plus Chof Yud. Correct? Kippurim. No wonder that many Goyim, among them I believe Rav Nachman Neuer Goyim, advised us the Tachanun binatum mitet anpoim. Since Purim is a day of supplication and petition. It comes as a surprise, but when you begin to investigate Aloha, you see that this is a basic definition of, a basic interpretation of Purim. As a matter of fact, the whole institution of Tiny Sester preceding Purim, we'll observe it on his next Thursday meal session. The whole institution rests upon this very dichotomy inherent in the festival of Purim and upon the paradoxical halachic requirement. It's a paradoxical requirement that Purim be observed both as a day of prayer and as a day of joyous celebration. Since it is impossible to comply with this paradoxical requirement, the rabbis advanced the observance of the prayer aspect of Purim, to the 13th of Adar. And the serious, prayerful mood, the frequent cry or shriek accompanying an itonis, and Tiny Sester is a regular itonis, the recital of Sliches, or the reading of Avinu Malkeinu, this serious mood belongs and is closely related to the very observance of Purim. Tiny Sester is not to be treated as an extraneous addendum to Purim, like Tiny Purim is in relationship to Pesach. Tiny Purim is an extraneous addendum to Pesach. It's not a part of the holiday of Pesach. Tiny Sester is not to be treated like that. It is a genuine Purim day on which the words of the psalmist, Elokai Ekro Lecho Yemom V'Lisane, Laila V'Leid Mirli, are translated literally into a liturgical reality. As a matter of fact, if you look up in Rambam, it is apparently that the Rambam is of the same opinion. There is an element, an aspect of prayer and supplication. There is a passional experience involved in the whole drama of Purim. But I cannot spend too much time on it. Of course, a question rises. How can Purim encompass two contradictory aspects? How? I would reformulate the question. On what metaphysical fact is this dialectic of Purim based? I believe that the answer is to be found in a human situation, if I may use the jargon of the existentialist, man is a frightened being. When I say frightened being, I don't mean psychologically. I mean ontologically, existentially. He's full of anxiety. Everybody knows about it. Which is a result of his greatness. This anxiety is not a result of human smallness, not of human greatness. He is frightened because he is great. He possesses faculties which have been denied to other creatures. Those unique faculties are the source of his fears and his troubles. Man basically is great and singular because he is capable of living in three realities at the same time. He can live in the reality of memory, accompanied by the melancholy awareness of things and people long gone. He can also live, and he does live, of course, in the reality which he can apprehend with his five senses, in the perceptional reality, what we call it present. However, man can also live in a third reality, in that of anticipation, where existence is equated with expectancy or tension, and where man is confronted by the unknown, and since it's unknown, it is frightening. What does the future hold in store for me? Man keeps asking himself without being able to answer this persistent question. The beast, for instance, is mortal just as man is. In fact, the lifespan of the animal is much shorter, usually, there are exceptions, much shorter than that of man. However, the latter does not know of death. It possesses neither memory nor the capability of anticipating events. So death is no problem to him. To the animal. Man has this capacity, the capability. Man is an anticipatory being, and therefore a frightened being, and an unhappy being. In a word, man is an insecure, frightened being. Or in other words, man, and I believe that this should be introduced as a new category in religious thinking, man is a vulnerable being, vulnerability. He is exposed to the absurd, what Aristotle called, and Maimonides in some places just uses the expression, to the absurd accident. Maimonides calls it carry. To at best, is exposed to at best an indifferent destiny. And man knows all that, and he is aware of his vulnerability and steady exposure. Which book did read? Did speak of human vulnerability? Which book? Yeah? Which book? Huh? Iev, simple. Yeah. Basically, Iev does not speak of the vulnerability of man. Of course, the first chapter, the story of Iev, tells us about vulnerability and exposure of man, yes. But the problem is not in the discussion, in dialogue between Job and his friends, Eliphaz, Sapphat, and Bilhah and Shuhi, The vulnerability was not discussed, not at all. The justice was discussed, yes. Job had many problems, yeah, but not vulnerability. Vulnerability is mentioned in two books. You know where? Huh? Kehelas, of course, and also a number of times in Tehillim. But the one who simply defined human vulnerability, he was Kehelas. What verse in Kehelas? What verse in Kehelas? Kileyeda odo misite, kadogim shenechozim bamsudo, vechatziporim lachuzis bepach, vohem yekshim bnei odom leisro, kishetipel aleyem pisein. For man knows not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net. Even so are the sons of men, snared in an evil time, when it falls suddenly upon them. Now I'll ask you a question. On what word should emphasis be placed? What should be underlined here in the whole passage? In the whole verse? What word should be underlined? What? A dog, you know, fish, I like fish, but... I don't believe, perhaps you are right, I'm wrong, but I believe that dog is chozog, the emphasis, the accent should be placed upon what word? Piton, correct. Piton. The emphasis should be placed upon the word piton. Suddenness. When fate strikes, it strikes suddenly, unexpectedly. Not always does sickness announce its coming, God forbid, through pain. Or sometimes sickness is not preceded by a signal. Nor does a violent economic or political change warn people in advance. Therefore, now there is an halachic conclusion from that. What is the halachic conclusion to be drawn from vulnerability of man, particularly the sudden change in which occurs in his life, the sudden blow, the unexpected surprise attack? There's a very important halachic conclusion. Without that, tefillah would be an impossibility. Because, let me use here just a term from our halachic lingo, tamechayev amin, the factor which precipitates prayer, or the source of prayer. Halachically, I'm not speaking here philosophically or theologically, what is the halachic factor which engenders the obligation to pray, the duty to petition the Almighty? Sorrow or tzeirach? Sorrow, correct, or I would, usually we interpret sorrow in terms of catastrophe, disaster. But tzeirach, need, human need, human need. While mystical prayer, for instance, placed the emphasis upon praise and thanksgiving and hymnal singing, Yahadus placed the accent upon petitional prayer, the so-called selfish, egotistic or egoistic prayer. But that prayer is the result of need. If there is no need, if a man feels that he's happy, feels happy and satisfied, all his needs are being gratified, not only there is no need for prayer, he shouldn't pray. Then every bracha would be a bracha levatela. He shouldn't pray. If man prays, it is because he is in need, in constant need. Why is man in constant need? Because man is vulnerable. Therefore, man is always in need. Therefore, we recite our prayers 3 times a day. One is, for instance, one is healthy. I just was discharged by the hospital. And they gave me a clean bill of health. But still, the next prayer, I'll recite Refrainu Ad Hashem Venerofe. Why? Why should I petition God for healing and cure? I don't need any cure. I don't need any medical help. Yes, I don't need now, then, you know what the answer is. I don't need help now, medical help. But I know not how I'll feel 5 minutes hence, or 5 seconds hence. For instance, a very rich man, a millionaire, asks God for a panos, for a livelihood, that he provide him with a livelihood. Isn't it funny? Not at all. Why? He knows nothing about the following day or about the morrow. In other words, if we take into consideration human vulnerability, we must arrive at one conclusion. There is no complete redemption. Of course, the Erev Yalim Bechi, at night, man was in distress, Bameitzah. In the morning, he woke up and he found himself free, breathing the clear air of Merchavto, of God's boundless spaces. This happened, the miracle happened. Yet, what his fate will be the next morning, he does not know. Vulnerability of man is the great tragic experience of man, and therefore there is no complete halal. Therefore, the halachic division of tefillah into 2 parts, basically 3 parts, but let us eliminate 1 part, into shevach ve'edoe, into praise and thanksgiving, and petition is a relative one. The division is not an absolute, strict division. There is no absolute halal service. It cannot be a service completely dedicated to halal. Nor is there pure petition. The halacha speaks of halal, and the halacha speaks of halal, he does so in a qualified manner. There is no thanksgiving which does not contain petition. Because no matter how great the miracle was, there is no promise. No promise is given that the catastrophic events, disastrous events, will not repeat themselves, will not reoccur. Every song of glory must be in willingly and in supplication. The song of joy coming from a liberated, happy man is ipso facto a cry from a frightened man. In fact, Hallel HaMitzri, the exalted song of joy, the Hallel par excellence, consists of 2 parts. Praise and thanksgiving on the one hand. For instance, the Psalms, Hallel Ko Alu Avdei Hashem, or Betzis Yisrael Mimitzvahim, belong to the category of praise and thanksgiving. But there is another part of prayer and petition, like Ohavati Leilonu, than the famous refrain, Onu Adishem Meishiyono. Very strange. Just 5 minutes ago, I was singing a great triumphant song of victory, B'tzeis Yisroel Mitzrayim, B'tzeis Yaakov Ma'amlez, B'tzeis Yisroel Kotshe Yisroel Ma'amshleisov. And now I see myself forsaken, forgotten, and I am appealing for help from the Almighty, Onu Adishem Meishiyono, help, because I am lonely, I am lost. To recite Hallel halachically means to sing and to cry at the same time. It is, of course, paradoxical, but the Jew is a paradoxical person in general, and we are a paradoxical people. But this paradoxality is a part of our liturgy. No wonder that Purim is both a day of joyous celebration and a day of prayer and meditation. No wonder that the Tzrias Amgileh is equated with that of Hallel, with the recital of praise, as well with Tachanunim, with the offering of prayers. Of course, the miracle was great, staggering, defying human imagination. The person who was supposed to be executed on the gallows, who was suddenly promoted to the office of viceroy, or prime minister, and the people who were doomed to total annihilation suddenly emerged as victorious. True, it was a great miracle. No doubt that that event deserved to be recorded for posterity, be remembered and celebrated. No doubt about it. That's why the Kriyas Amgileh was ordained and Purim declared as a day of joy and gladness. However, if circumstances and events can change so quickly, literally, overnight, if a prime minister who just yesterday enjoyed the full confidence and trust of the king, who was suddenly convicted and executed, and I'm not sorry for it. Who is wise enough, wise and clairvoyant enough to assure us that the same unreasonable, absurd, neurotic change of mood and mind will not repeat itself? Where is the fortune teller who could assert or assure us that Ahasuerus will not replace Esther Amalke with another fair woman, and that he'll do to her exactly what he did to Vashti, his first queen? The Megillah in general is the book of the specific vulnerability of man, and specifically of the vulnerability of the Jew. The events recorded in the Megillah are nonsensical. A king signs away the lives of hundreds of thousands of people without even inquiring about their identity. He never asks Homer who these people is or those people are. Three or four days later, he denies the whole story. He does not remember, he says, that such an edict was ever signed and sealed, and that Haman was responsible for it. Can such a king be relied upon? less than on the administration in Washington. Purim could not have been introduced. Purim could not have been introduced just as a festival, as a day of merrymaking. Purim had to be set up as a dual holiday, dual in character and dual in manner of observance. Where did the Jew experience the most absurd vulnerability, if not in Shushan? Vulnerability of man is not only a tragic vulnerability of man is not only a tragic truth or effect, it is more than that. The vulnerability of man is an ethical, halachic postulate. This awareness, the awareness of vulnerability, of being exposed, and the suddenness of the attack, engenders many ethical virtues, among which the most important one is humility. Without vulnerability, there is no humility. Without the awareness of vulnerability, there is no modesty. Of course, we all know that humility is perhaps the highest ethical virtue. Maimonides even suspended his golden rule, the rule of the golden mean, which applied to many emotions, to all emotions. He did suspend this rule vis-à-vis humility. One has got to be very humble. Hevesh fal ruach meid, hevesh fal ruach. Now is a question, all right, humility is very important. The opposite of humility is arrogance, pride, vanity. How can humility be achieved? And there's another question. Why should men be modest? Why should men be shy? Why should he be humble? Particularly, why should successful men be humble? He has the right, prima facie, to be proud of himself, to be arrogant toward those who did not succeed in life, toward those who failed in life. In fact, man is inclined to be arrogant, to be impudent, to be aggressive. Man is inclined to reach out for things which are above and beyond his legitimate reach. Arrogance of man is, of course, the consequence of victory. The feelings of self-assurance, self-righteousness, which accompany success, they result in pride and in arrogance. However, all those feelings, the human pride and arrogance, disappear the very moment man becomes aware of his vulnerability. And of the suddenness with which fortune changes. In other words, the awareness of vulnerability of man is a cathartic awareness, a cleansing awareness, awareness which purges man, which has a redemptive impact upon man. It is awareness which ennobles man, because the alternative is pride and vanity. Humility is the expression of that awareness. We will read in the Megillah, Mordechai Misalech Nechatza Beis Anoshim Vodas Shlom Esther Uma Yosebo. Had Mordechai abandoned caution and adopted the attitude of the arrogant fool, of the so-called nouveau riche, had he let everybody know that he was the father or uncle, I don't know, I mean, what he could have said, of the queen. Of course, I mean, by telling the people, the courtiers and the servants of the royal palace, he would have told them that he is related to the queen, related, very close relation to the queen. He would have commanded their respect. But however, had he been proud and vain and boastful, had he bragged about the fact that he is a relation of the queen, the whole miracle would not have happened. The miracle was made possible by Mordecai's caution and humility. He was silent, humble. He was waiting for something to happen. He knew that the more fantastic the success story is, the more vulnerable man is. The most vulnerable man in the United States is the president. Man is vulnerable, is the vulnerability of man is proportionate to his greatness. The greater the success, the more vulnerable he is. And the more intense is the need for prayer. Mordechai knew that Esther climbed up to the very heights of success. But the more cautious Mordechai was, and because of Mordechai's humility, and because of the awareness of vulnerability and caution, the great miracle happened, took place. Let me make here a parenthetical remark, and please, I don't want you to misinterpret me. We'll tell you what I have in mind. And don't try to distort what I said. Because lately people are distorting my statements. The vulnerability of the Jew is not limited to the Jew in the diaspora. Of course, the Megillah relates the story of a diaspora community. However, the destiny charged vulnerability awareness of the Jew is universal. It is an integral part of the universal Jewish, universal experience of man in general and the Jewish experience in particular. And as such, it is all inclusive, all encompassing. It applies to everybody, to individual and state, to private person and community. We are all vulnerable. The government in Israel, in general, and the top echelon of the military leadership, lived during 7 years in a mood of arrogance and forgot the principle of vulnerability of man. No one is an exception to the rule. No one is excluded from that. That's why we find ourselves in a very unpleasant situation, to say the least. Vulnerability leads to humility, humility to caution, and caution leads to suspect, to success. But if the awareness of vulnerability is lacking, then man becomes arrogant, and arrogance leads to errors and to mistakes. And mistakes are the cause of failure. It's good to remember now, because we are confronted by a horrible enemy. We will have to make very, very serious decisions. In the halacha, the principle of vulnerability makes tefillah possible. Man is always in it. But many halachas are rooted in the fact of that man is a vulnerable being. For instance, we have many laws pertaining to safety, and our code is replete with them. We saw some dummies, you build a marker around your house, your roof. All those laws are rooted in the notion of human exposure to this so-called accident. In my opinion, the whole concept of vasus yod latera, build a fence around the law, is rooted in the notion of vulnerability, of not only physical but also spiritual man. Not only the body is vulnerable, but the human spirit is vulnerable, exposed. The human intellect, the human fantasy are exposed to all kinds of pressures and influences, and that's why a fence is necessary. Man is vulnerable both as a physical being and as a spiritual personality. Vulnerability of man is a very important principle from a theological viewpoint. We Jews believe that man is judged by his maker. The concept of mishpat u'tzedakah is a central one in our thinking. Man is judged when, how often, how frequently, we have diverse opinions. Once a year, or according to one opinion, every day, but man is judged by his maker. And woe to man if he is found wanting. If men is judged, the question rises, how can he win? How can he be acquitted? And if I forget to ask this question, Ha'ene ish meleka yitzdok? Shall mortal man be just before God? Ime seyu yitzar gover? Shall a man be pure before his maker? How can men win the trial? And be pronounced innocent. The rescue for man, the rescue of man is due to his vulnerability. Man is acquitted by his maker because man is vulnerable. The vulnerability of man is a factor which mitigates the harshness of God's judgment. Yes, man is a sinner. Question is, why does he sin? Why did man listen to the serpent? Why does he violate the moral law? The answer is, because man has been and still is vulnerable, exposed to all kinds of pressures. He is easily persuaded, indeed brainwashed, and quickly defeated. At times, he is challenged by an intellectual, agnostic society, as it is true of the present. At another time, he is intoxicated with hedone, the pursuit of pleasure. Quite often, he is pulled by political social movements which appear under the disguise of redeemers. In a word, the environment scoffs at his commitments and promises. He sins because he's a weakling, because fate defeated him. Some are saints and righteous people because they were born into a home of saintliness and righteousness. Some are sinners because they were born into a house atheism and agnosticism. Should the wicked be found guilty? Why is he wicked? Because he is vulnerable to external pressures and he yields easily. And the answer is no. He is not guilty. And that's how man wins when he stands before the Almighty, before the heavenly bar of justice. And how beautifully the Mishneh in Yuma says, Shnei Sire Yema Kippurim Shoven Bemare Bekemo Bedomim Venil Kochim Kechot. The two Sirim, or the two He-Goats of Yom Kippur, should be alike in appearance, alike in size, and alike in value, and have been bought at the same time. If the space Sirim, if the two Sirim are alike, exactly like identical things, why should one be consecrated to the Almighty and the second one to Azazel? Why the discrepancy as to their destinies? The answer is obvious. What's the answer? What's the answer? Two lots were cast over them. One lot had the letters Lashay. The second lot, and the second lot, the letters Lazozel were engraved. And the mere accidental performance by the archpriest, by the king Gadol, by placing blindly a one lot upon one Seir and another lot upon the other Seir, determined their future. The Nosanari now Shnea Sirim Girolis, Girolechot Ladishem, Girolechot Lazazel. The secret of atonement is hidden in the ceremonial casting of the lots. Because man sins under duress and constraint, under the pressure of hostile accidents, he is found not guilty, innocent, before the bar of justice. And what is Purim? What is the word, the semantics of the word Purim? If not what? If not just casting of a lot, just giral, these unreasonable, absurd accident which brought about the edict by Ahasuerus. Now let me ask you one question. Is it possible? Is there something accidental, absurd in nature or in history? Do we have the right to speak about Geron or about Mazel? I mean, we know what the opinion of the ancient Greeks was. They answered the question in the positive. They looked upon fate as upon something absurd, unalterable and ruthless, that at best is indifferent to the aspirations of man. And the clash between man and fate, between intelligence and inert matter, is in their view the source of human tragedy. Man is always the loser, matter is the winner. However, Yehadus, even though it knew of and tried to understand catastrophic events that viciously destroy man, his dreams and hopes, Yehadus could not accept the existence of something unreasonable in human life. Yehadus, even though she herself told us this story, of the whirlwind which came from across the wilderness, smote the four corners of the house, killing everybody, even though she herself told us the story, could not look upon the whirlwind or the great wind as an absurd accident. According to Yehadus, there are no accidents in being. Yehadus maintains that events which we call unreasonable and which we classify under the rubric of accident or fate belong to a higher divine order into which man has not been initiated. While man was granted the opportunity to gain some insight in the ordinary scientific logic which deals with regular events, he was denied the privilege of understanding the so-called Gerol during events which impress us as being irregular, incoherent happenings. Men cannot grasp the relationship between the individual and its environment, and its environment. However, even the most unreasonable event may begin to reveal structural patterns in retrospection. Retrospection sheds a light upon many enigmatic, allegedly unreasonable events. When men views those events in the context of experiences which followed them, the freakish event may appear to be a regular one. In hindsight, many events become understandable. V'royo ba'aver kvedi v'samticho b'nikra satsur v'royiso es achurai v'fonai le'yero. While God passes by, while the event takes place, while the historical drama is being unfolded, one cannot understand what is happening. However, after God's passing by, in retrospective meditation, in glancing backwards, you may begin to see God's back or the contours of reasonableness in an event which you consider and classify as absurd and unreasonable. If this be true, then it is legitimate to ask a question about the Purim experience. To ask the question, why was the Purim experience necessary at all? Of course, we are asking, let's say, in humility, because in general the question why should not be addressed to the Almighty. I would rather suggest, instead of why, to ask, what is the message that the Purim experience is trying to, the Purim experience has formulated for the Jew. What is it? In context of our lecture, we may ask, what did the Purim experience achieve, basically? It's very strange. Chazal or rabbis ascribed great significance to the Purim experience. The latter has precipitated, according to their opinion, the reaffirmation of the covenant, or the confirmation of the old commitment, Naseh v'Nishma. Roma Rove of Pekin, Hodar Kablu, Benea Hashverish, Nursibu Kimu Vikibu Ayudim, Kimu Mashikibu Tor. And even the text of the Megillah itself bears witness to the great impact that the experience had on the Jewish people. The Divri Yemei Apurim Le'Yavu Metech Ayudim V'Zichom Le'Yosef Mizarom, that these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. And the verse is related not only to the observance of Purim as a day of feasting and joy, but to the unique message contained in the experience of Purim. Apparently, the Almighty wanted the Jews to derive several very important conclusions from the Purim experience. And indeed, the Jews did arrive such conclusions from the whole Purim drama, which, as I said, reflected vulnerability of the Jew, and at first glance, complete absurdity and nonsense. The way Ahasuerus acted, the way many actors in that drama, acted. Conclusion number one. The Jews discovered, and they keep on discovering, in every generation, that Kol Adam Kezev, in plain English, means that man is a liar. However, it's not a question of man being a liar or man being truthful. Something more serious is involved. The Jews have discovered that man goes from time to time, berserk, turns into a monster, and replaces his divine personality with a satanic personality. In other words, man is capable of personifying total evil. This discovery was an agonizing, traumatic experience for the Jews in Persia, and since then it has been an agonizing, difficult experience for Jews in all countries of the world. Why? The Jew believed, and still does, and still believes, that man was created in the image of God. Hence there is a divine spark in man, in every man, not excluding the habitual sinner or criminal. Deep down the Jew maintained, and is still maintaining, there is something good in every man, but even in the sinner. The Jew believed and still believes in man. After all, the whole concept of Tshuva, the possibility of Tshuva, and the expectation that mankind will finally, come back to the Almighty, is based upon that principle, that there is something intrinsically good in man. And the Jew in Persia, who encountered Haman, and the German Jew in Germany and other countries, European countries, who encountered Hitler, and American Jews who encounter from time to time, enemies, fiends, discover that man can incarnate total evil. And always the awakening is a rude one. Awakening. Apparently, Haman proved to them that there is an alternative to being divine. And that alternative consists in being Satan. In other words, the Jew in Persia met whom? We have a good word for that. Whom? Amalek. Who is Amalek? We, after all, we read the Parsha Zohar every year. As a matter of fact, we read four texts pertaining to Amalek. We read last chapter in the text, after Seitzei, we read Ampurim, Vayov Amalek, Ve'elochem, Ve'Yisrael. We read the Aftere of Shmuel and Shaul, and we will read also what we read. The Megillah. Megillah is death of Amalek. Who is Amalek? A man who personifies total evil. to whom immorality becomes a norm. Who is Amor? Of course, it was a wandering Bedouin tribe, most probably. Yes. But the Pasuk is quite serious when it says, Milchomo la v'shem ba'amolik midir dor. God has declared an eternal war on Amalek throughout the generations. I would say it would be below the dignity of God to declare eternal war on the Bedouin tribe. And Amalek will be defeated only at the commencement of the Messianic era. No one will be capable of defeating Amalek. The final defeat of Amalek will take place when the King Messiah will arrive. So who is Amalek? It isn't just a Bedouin tribe. It's not a race, nor is it a group, a nationality. It is men who went berserk. Man who incarnates total evil, man Satan. He can either be created in the image of God or in the image of Satan. Man demon is Amalek. I once heard from my father, in the name of my grandfather, that any people or any group of people who is committed to one purpose, to destroy the Jewish people, is to be classed, such a group is to be classified as Amalek. If one writes on its banner, L'chu v'nachride migoy, v'le'yizocher shem Yisrael eit bo'elon, bo'oretz, acquires the status of Amalek, and the commandment of Moche Timche is applicable to him or to them. And quite often Amalek or man Satan succeed in his attempt to gain power and to cause untold suffering to millions or hundreds of millions of people. I believe it's our generation. I'm not speaking of most of you are young, but I'm speaking of people who are as old as I am. Our generation encountered a few of them. There's no doubt about it that Hitler was Amalek, no doubt about it. I'm speaking now in halachical terms. Hitler and his entourage and company. There is no doubt that Stalin had the status of Amalek, also incarnation of total evil. I have doubts about the generous Mr. Leonid Brezhnev. And about Mao Zedong, I don't know. But I have serious doubts about it. Now that I'm concerned over Confucius and Beethoven, but I don't know. Intuitively I feel that there is incarnation of evil. Of total evil. This is one discovery that you made due to the incident of the Purim drama. Something else was discovered by the Jew. A second discovery that you made. Namely, Amalek, man Satan, hates everybody. Because the dictionary, when you see Satan, will say, what will he say? Well, how do they describe Satan? The enemy of man, in general. Or the adversary of man. This is Satan. Hates everybody. He enjoys causing misery and injury to all men. All are alike. Yet Satan Non-Satan or Amalek is particularly preoccupied with the Jews. It's something irrational. It's something crazy, absurd, mad. But he is preoccupied with the Jew. He hates the Jew more than anybody else. And in causing suffering and pain to the Jew, he finds his greatest delight. And let me tell you, and it doesn't matter what Amalek represents, what the Satan represents. Sometimes the Satan represents the social, economic, socio-political program of the Satan is completely irrelevant in that. Sometimes the Satan represents progress. He is progressive. Sometimes he's reactionary. Sometimes he's agnostic, secular. And sometimes he's religious, clerical. The hate of the Jew is the central preoccupation of Amalek, regardless of his social, political, and economic commitments. As I said before, it was a rude awakening. The Jew discovered, and the Jew keeps on discovering, something which is quite simple. The Jew in Persia discovered for the first time that there is somebody who hates them. No other nation can brag about it. You cannot say there is somebody who hates America, who hates Germany, who hates France. No. And if there is hatred, it is due to war, to a clash of interests, to competition. But the Jew can despite say there is somebody in this world. Whether this somebody is one individual or this somebody is a million or 60 million people. Is completely, or 800 million people, or 700 million people, is completely irrelevant. But there is somebody who hates me. And the hate of the Jew can erupt like a volcano at any time. The mere existence of the Jew irritates Amalek. The mere presence of the Jew provokes the wrath. The answer, it's completely absurd. It's unreasonable. It's mad. But it is a reality. And somehow, the Jews get entangled in events which lie completely outside of their concern. You all know the story of the biblical ram, which Abraham caught and sacrificed instead of Isaac. What was the ram? The ram was caught in the thicket by his horns. It's symbolic of the Jew. The Jew is always caught in the thicket of events which are completely unrelated to him, to which he has no relationship. He is always between two great empires. And he has to cast his, so to say, his lot with the more decent one. They found out that to hate the Jew, hate of the Jew, is capable of being translated into violence of apocalyptic proportions, into a satanic attempt of total destruction. And let me tell you, I mean, it's not only Hitler came up with this idea. The idea, when the actually priority should be given to Haman. I mean, he was the first one. If you hate the Jews, so destroy him, right? Or why suffer him? Since he, but Haman also, the Chorzein and Ushevali, Bishosh Avshka, and Rei Mordechai, Yehudi Yeshu, Bishar Amalach. He irritates, the presence of Mordechai irritated Haman. He couldn't stand him. So since he couldn't stand him, so the best solution to the problem was to execute him, to hang him. For instance, let's not fool ourselves. The problem of Eretz Israel, the state of Israel, is not a problem only of the existence of a political institution like state. Simply, our enemies want simply to destroy not only the state as a political institution, but the issue as well. Third, he made a third discovery, the Jew, in Persia, and the German Jews made it in Germany, and every Jew makes this discovery in his respective country. The hostility toward the Jew by Amalek, by men Satan, is not directed exclusively against the religious Jew, who is conspicuous in his being different and unique. The hate embraces religious as well as agnostic Jews, the nationalist Jew as well as the assimilationist Jew.